We delve back into the book of Ecclesiastes this week. Some of you might have considered the family camp last week a welcome respite, a welcome relief from the anthem of meaninglessness and the seeming despair that the preacher of Ecclesiastes seems to put us in. Whilst I hope the camp was an enjoyable time and an encouragement to us all who attended, I also hope that we haven't seen Ecclesiastes as all but meaningless and despair, but actually an encouraging word for us. Just to get us back into the swing of this series, I'd like to read to you with a little paraphrasing, I guess, or just share with you how one writer, a fellow called John Winter, introduces the book of Ecclesiastes. He writes, "The book of Ecclesiastes often reads like a diary of despair, sometimes portraying life in what might seem to be a sick joke, with death as the punchline. Full of what one writer has called cynical wisdom, mostly directing the reader to the meaninglessness of life, yet sometimes urging him to make the most of it, and even in the end, instructing him to fear God and keep his commandments. His journey towards that conclusion is sometimes tortuous." I think Wayne said relentless in its meaning and its message. "Sometimes tortuous as he honestly grapples with the evidence that lies before him under the sun, yet he never abandons his belief in a sovereign creator God, who in the end is the master of his destiny. The glimpses the author gives us above the sun shine out of the gloom of his materialistic conclusions." He goes on to liken the book. Has anyone seen Schindler's List, the movie of Oskar Schindler? A number of us here. He likens it to that movie which portrays Oskar Schindler, who at one stage in his life witnessed the Nazi attacks rounding up Jews for deportation to a death camp. And he was just astonished at the ferocity of the Nazi attack. And he said at one point later, "Beyond that day, no thinking person could fail to see what would happen. And he was now resolved to do everything in his power to defeat the system." Schindler was a womanizer, he a lover of the good life. He had amassed a lot of wealth through bribery and corruption, exploiting every opportunity he had as a member of the Nazi party. But in light of what he saw, the good life to him became utterly meaningless. And he went on to risk his life and his fortune, spend his fortune, dying penniless, saving hundreds of Jews. John Winter, the writer of this commentary, then goes on to talk about how when Steven Spielberg portrayed Schindler's List in the movie, you might remember it was all shot in black and white, except for the flickering of candles, just portraying some hope and a little girl in a red coat. And he writes, "Ecclesiastes is life portrayed in stark and honest clarity, sometimes almost brutal in that honesty, isn't it? But life portrayed in black and white, emphasising the captivity and destruction of a whole race, the human race gathered together under the sun, caught up in and captive to the system, and under the dark shadow of death. But there is colour in the book of Ecclesiastes. The occasional candle flickers, and soon others begin to glow and illuminate the scene, and the brightest colour appears when the cameras focus upon one person, vividly illuminated against the drab backdrop, not a little girl in a red coat, but God, the creator of human beings. And as the camera pans away and the whole span of biblical history is revealed, like the little girl in the red coat, we see that same God among the seething mass of humanity, sharing in their suffering and death in Jesus Christ." The book that portrays the pointlessness of everything really does have a point to make. This morning, as we open up in chapter 5 of this book, we're bathed in a splash of that colour amidst the stark black and white honesty of the rest of the book. The preacher, in one sense, breaks from his quest for a moment. He breaks his commentary on life under the sun, and for the first time so far in the book, he admonishes or instructs his readers. And he does so in such an abrupt way. If we were reading the book of Ecclesiastes just straight through, not stopping at each chapter and verse or the breaks, but reading it straight through, it would catch us by surprise. After talking about life under the sun, meaningless without God, and just everything so meaningless and monotonous, and then we're instructed, chapter 5, "Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. It just comes out of nowhere. This morning we hear it as our first verse, but in the midst of the book, God's mentioned and we're to approach him. Very different to life under the sun. God breaks into and upon the monochrome meaninglessness of life under the sun, where, as we heard a few weeks ago, nothing ever happens. Nothing happens at all. The needle returns to the start of the song, and we all sing along like before. But as God breaks into that life under the sun, at the same time, he comes in and breaks us out of it. He breaks us out from the meaninglessness into glorious array as we're exhorted to worship him. And the great goal of what he's doing, of that great goal of redemption paid in full by the blood of Christ, is that we would be to the praise of his glory and grace as we worship him in all our life. You see, the truth of the matter, I was sharing with someone during the week and we were talking about how we're going through the series. We thought, how does this work out in life? Just down to earth, day to day, life, work, home, family. And the truth of the matter is you could have two people doing exactly the same thing, side by side, with exactly the same results, having exactly the same amount of money, with the same amount of wealth, same amount of possessions, same level of competence, and one of them would be carrying on under the sun, with no meaning and no substance to what they're doing, whereas the other could be full of meaning and purpose and substance, on the outside looking identical. Not because one person's work lasts longer and the other one doesn't, or one earns more and the other one doesn't. All of that might be completely equal. But because one does it to the glory of God and the other does it for his own gain. Because whilst one does it according to his own might and his own means and his own strength, the other does it in the joy and strength of the Lord. One might do it in the pursuit of joy, in the pursuit of wealth, whereas the other does it in the context of joy and contentment and thanksgiving for all that he has, serving the Lord and doing it all to his glory. One, the book of Ecclesiastes tells us, is meaningless and actually amounts to nothing, nothing at all, like a vapor. That's the stark reality and brutal honesty that the preacher gives us. Whilst the other, doing the same thing with all the same stuff, is full of meaning and eternal value. Because the things of faith and love abide forever as we walk in the good works that he's prepared beforehand for us to walk in. Today we're shown by the preacher how it is we're to break out of that monotonous cycle of meaninglessness. Or rather, maybe not how, but who it is who breaks that cycle, who brings us up out from under the sun. And in that, where our feet should be pointing, where our eyes should be looking and who our ears should be listening to. All of our labours, our toil, our wealth, they can provide some gain. It doesn't all have to be meaningless. It can be more than vanity, more than hebel, a mere vapour, here one day and gone the next. In chapter 5 today, we're called to step out from under the sun, and to do that, we're to step into the presence of God, into the house of God. And as we do that, to listen to his word. Guard your steps, the preacher writes, when you go into the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that what they are doing is evil. Be not rash with your mouth, nor let your heart be hasty to utter a word before God. For God is in heaven, and you are on earth. Therefore let your words be few. Verse 7, where dreams increase and words grow many, there is vanity, but God is the one you must fear. Worship is not a meaningless under the sun activity. Worship is not a meaningless under the sun activity. True worship in spirit and truth, as the Father desires, is not an under the sun activity, and so it's only as we approach God and consider all that he's given us with thankfulness in our hearts and with joy, only then can we find that meaning and rest for our souls as we sing. Here is true and everlasting wisdom. It's in the fear of the Lord, not in the pursuit of anything else. Any other way is actually meaninglessness meaningless and are striving after the wind. As I've been thinking about and praying about this week, I've actually wondered if the book of Ecclesiastes isn't actually all about worship. What is it we look to for contentment? What is it we give our worth to? What is it we look to give our lives meaning and purpose and life and joy, security? Who do we serve, or what do we serve? Ourselves or our Creator? If our eyes are hooked on anything under the sun, if our pursuit is only for selfish indulgence or pleasure, then, well, the scriptures call it idolatry. Just as Paul writes in Romans 1, claiming to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images resembling mortal man, birds, animals, creeping things, and we could add technology, materialism, whatever, worshipping gifts from God instead of God the giver. Trying to find our security in those gifts rather than the one who gives. Which takes us to the conclusion, really, of Ecclesiastes, doesn't it? Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. The difference between life lived under the sun and life lived out from under the sun is a matter of worship. It's a matter of where our feet are heading, a matter of where our eyes are looking and what our ears are listening to. And if I can break stride for a minute and jump out of Ecclesiastes into the New Testament rather than leaving it just to the end of the sermon, it's the Father who actually seeks and desires our worship, isn't it? And it's the Father who's provided all that's needed for us to come out from under the sun and to worship Him. It's the Father through the Son, S-O-N, not S-U-N, but through His Son, Christ, who's freed us from the bondage of being under the sun and caught up in idolatry. As we heard last weekend, He's transferred us out of the domain of darkness and into the kingdom of His beloved Son, that we might worship Him as children and heirs. The writer of Hebrews, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered Himself without blemish to God, how much more will His blood purify our conscience from dead works, so that we might serve, so that we might worship, same word, so that we might serve or worship the living God. You see, there's far more to life than what we see and do under the sun. Because as we're told here, God is in heaven. There is a God we must fear, who in every aspect of life we're to consider and acknowledge and revere. Apart from Him, all our dreams, all our aspirations, all our many words, they're meaningless. But with God, who we can approach, who we can draw near to, not with selfish, lofty petitions and requests saying, Lord, help me and bless my pursuits. But actually, Lord, all my pursuits are in Your hands. All my joy comes only from You. We come to Him and draw near to Him to listen. Not with rash vows and empty promises saying, Lord, I'll commit more, I'll do more if this happens. But we come before Him and to hear His word, to hear His promises of commitment to us. To listen to the Lord doesn't necessarily mean for us to sit in silent meditation in prayer, although that might be a really good thing to do. But the Lord's given us wonderful means to hear His word, hasn't He? He's given us His written word, that we could read it, we could hear it, we could proclaim it. He's given us the Old Testament, the New Testament, God's own witness and revelation of Himself to us. The Spirit to grant us wisdom and insight and understanding as we read it. He's given us pastors and teachers, gifts to the church who expound that word so that we might hear His voice to us today and worship Him in fear and reverence. That we might know that everything we have is from His hands. Only then, as we hear His voice, will we know peace and be thankful and have worship filling our hearts. Only then can we actually rest in our labour and from our labours, knowing that it's the Lord who provides. You see, we might work hard pursuing our dreams, prosperity, but the Lord is working harder still pursuing us. Psalm 23, surely goodness and mercy will follow me, will pursue me all the days of our life. amazing thing is when it comes to worship in God's holiness and his wisdom, his high and lofty heavenly dwelling, is that we can approach him. We can approach him. This one who is ruler, who's holy and sovereign, creator of all things, we can draw near to him. Confidently, yes, but not casually, guarding our steps. But we can do so because on this side of the cross especially, we know that he's actually drawn near to us. As Wayne mentioned, I think, in his prayer, that God has stooped down and come to us in his Son. Guard your steps, says the preacher, chapter 5. Watch where you're heading in life. Be careful then how you walk, Paul says in Ephesians. Not as wise but unwise, making the best use of the time, because the days are evil. Don't be foolish, but understand, Paul says, what the will of the Lord is. How are we to understand what the will of the Lord is? Well, listen to him. Read his word. Hear his voice. Now, worship is far more than a passive under-the-sun activity, isn't it? It's not just a pastime. It's far more than what we do just in the singing, which this morning I just thought was wonderful. I was sitting here and I had a little tenor choir, I think, standing behind me. It was beautiful. But our worship is active, it's practical, and it's relevant for every aspect of life, far beyond just a Sunday morning. And in this fifth chapter of Ecclesiastes, we're just shown a wonderful image of the generosity of God in each and every aspect of life. Yes, we approach him with care, with reverence and holy awe. But be assured of this. Our enjoyment in life is not something that happens or something that we find away from the scrutiny of an overbearing God who's watching our every footstep. Enjoyment is not something that we have apart from God's strict law and high moral standards. Not at all. The writer of Ecclesiastes tells us that our joy and the power to enjoy all the good gifts of God actually comes from God himself. Joy and life and all our enjoyment and pleasure is not found apart from God. Far from it. It's all received from him. If we look for it anywhere else, we're going to come up empty, which is where the preacher goes. We'll come up unsatisfied. Chapter 5, verse 18. Behold, what I've seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him. For this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. The enjoyment of all the good things we have is a gift from God, as well as all the good things. Now, have you ever noticed in scriptures how often God tells us, he commands us to have joy? He commands us to rejoice. You ever notice that? Let the righteous one rejoice in the Lord. Ecclesiastes chapter 11 says, rejoice, O young man, in your youth, telling us to rejoice. Let your heart cheer you. Rejoice in the Lord always, Paul says. And again, I say rejoice, Philippians. Rejoice always, one of the shortest verses after Jesus wept. Rejoice always in 1 Thessalonians 5. They're commands. They're not options. Not things we get at the end of life or at the end of something. It's what we're told to do now, is rejoice in the Lord. And whenever God commands us to do something, right through Scripture, right through history, whenever God commands us, he also provides all we need, his blessing and the power to do the very thing he's commanded us to do. If we're commanded to rejoice, then we're given the power and the blessing and the obligation to obey and to have joy, or not to. But it's God who gives even the power to enjoy his goodness and generosity. And I pray this morning and each week as we gather that we would prepare ourselves and ready ourselves, not just getting the kids ready, if you've got kids, and finally get in the car and then sit down with a sigh of relief as they're taken off to Sunday school. Okay, now I can rest. That might happen too. That as we gather in the presence of the Lord, have we come ready and eager, joy in our hearts, to listen to the Lord? The great Shema of Deuteronomy 6 for God's people, hear, O Israel,
the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Jesus warns with his parables, be careful then how you hear. He who has an ear, let him hear. Those who bear much fruit are those who hear the word of the Lord and hold fast to it. Lord, grant us mercy that we might hear his voice this morning and listen to his word. Now, I don't know if any of that makes you squirm a little. Maybe it's helpful to squirm sometimes, especially if it's under the loving grace of God that we squirm. But as the writer of Ecclesiastes makes it perfectly clear, the reason we need to ask ourselves is, are we listening to God? Are we prepared and ready? Is because there's a whole lot of voices. There's many, many voices in the world, all of them vying for our attention. Some intentionally determined to distract us from the word of the Lord and twist his word, just like the serpent did in the garden. All of them vying for our attention, but none of them able to bear any fruit. So we prepare ourselves and we encourage one another, hear the word of the Lord. We need to actually block out those other voices. Direct our feet and our ears to listen to him. Because all the others actually lead to meaningless life, futility, and ultimately actually death. If we don't weigh up and discern those other voices in the light of the living and life-giving word of God. You see, there's corruption all around us, isn't there? Have a look at verse 8 of chapter 5. It speaks of that corruption and the endless hunger that the worship of anything but God leaves us with. And we shouldn't actually be surprised that there's corruption in the world. Verse 8, if you see in the province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, don't be amazed. Don't be surprised at the matter. Why? Well, because the high official who's over all of that oppression and corruption, he's been watched by another. Which means what? If he's been watched but there's corruption and oppression there, well, guess what the other one's doing? He's getting his own two bobs worth at the same time and letting it happen. And then he's watched by another as well. So the corruption's going to be there wherever there's power. But this is gain for a land in every way, a king committed to cultivating fields, even in the midst of corruption. If there's some agricultural foresight, agricultural encouragement, then there is some benefit. But the world system remains for now, together with the corruption of sinful humanity. Some of the great preaching in Acts, save yourself from this evil, corrupt generation. How? Well, receive the word of Christ, receive the forgiveness of sins, receive the Spirit. But rather than trying to beat the system in its own game and fighting fire with fire, or worse still, if you can't beat them, join them and you try to suck out of the system every last morsel we can squeeze out of it. Instead, the preacher tells us that we can actually be content and find rest, even when we are aware, sadly, of the corruption around us. We can be content with what the Father's given us, rather than joining the endless rat race under the sun, pursuing more and more, and in doing so, sucking out more and more from others who become less and less. Did you know the law of God given to the people of God as they wandered around in the wilderness and then as they entered the promised land? It actually stipulated that their fields, which they would farm, they would sow their seed and harvest, that around the edges of their fields they weren't to harvest, just around the edge. They had to actually leave that there. Sow it, yes, but not pick it. Nor were they to strip their vineyards bare or any grapes that had fallen to the ground. They had to leave there. Why? Well, for the poor, for the stranger, for those that had nothing, for the wanderer who had no other means of food. Now, it wasn't just an act of generosity or social welfare. It was actually an act of faith. Even though they hadn't farmed every square cubit of their fields, God would provide enough and more than enough so that others would be provided for. To not do that, to disobey that law, wasn't just selfish or lack of compassion, nor was it just disobedience. It was actually, first and foremost, a lack of faith that God would provide, that God had given the harvest. Most of us here might not have fields or vineyards to look after, but we have other areas in life, don't we, that carry the same principle. Whether that be the last bit of toothpaste in the tube, or our taxes and our superannuation, if we're prone to scraping the bottom of the barrel selfishly just so we ensure we don't miss out, just so we ensure somebody else doesn't get what is rightfully ours, and if we don't have a generous heart, we will never be content with what the Lord's given us. Because we'll always think we haven't got enough. We've got to get more. Because we haven't recognised in the first place that God's given everything we have. Any profit, any morsel, big or small, all the harvest, all the fruit is gift from God. And we won't see that if our worship and our trust is misplaced. You see, the selfish quest for money, wealth, riches, anything, it's actually futile. And it's a never-ending and meaningless pursuit. And it will never take us to a point of contentment. Have a look at verse 10 of chapter 5. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money. It's pretty blunt, isn't it? Nor he who loves wealth with his income. This also is vanity. When goods increase, those who eat them increase. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a labourer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. Have you ever noticed that? The acquisition for wealth and possessions actually only serves to increase the appetite for more. It's like trying to limit yourself to one nice, hot, salty chip. You ever tried to stop at just one chip? Or a piece of chocolate? That first taste only leaves you hungry for the next one and the next one. It might be said that a rolling stone gathers no moss. Keep on moving and you'll eventually get somewhere. Stay still for too long and you just end up, well, green and furry. But the Rolling Stones, the band, they knew a little bit about life under the sun and the never-ending meaninglessness of the world. Now, sadly, whilst I don't think Mick Jagger and Keith Richards ultimately came to the same conclusion as the preacher in Ecclesiastes, they tried a whole lot of stuff under the sun, didn't they? And they came up empty. And they sang, I can't get no satisfaction. I try and I try and I try and I try. Do you know the verses of the song? Some of you might, and it might show you a generation. It's a bit beyond, before my time. When I'm driving my car and the man comes on the radio, he's telling me more and more about some useless information supposed to fire my imagination, but I can't get any satisfaction. When I'm watching my TV and the man comes on and tells me how white my shirts can be. When I'm doing this and signing that and trying to make some girl who tells me, baby, better come back next week, I can't get no, 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 no. Hey, hey, hey. I can't get no satisfaction. Because I try and I try and I try and I try. Sound familiar? Ecclesiastes 1, I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. I tried and I tried and I tried. But it's an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. I've seen everything that's done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity, meaningless, a striving after the wind. Chapter 6, we've heard today. There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, verse 1. It lies heavy on mankind, a man to whom God gives wealth and possessions and honour so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires, yet God does not give him the power to enjoy them. But a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity, a grievous evil. In verse 7 of chapter 6, maybe this is where Mick Jagger got it from. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is a vanity, a striving after the wind. All that we do and all that we work for, says the preacher, under the sun, is ultimately to satisfy our appetite, but it's never satisfied. Beginning of chapter 5, we're told to be careful about what comes out of our mouth, ensuring that it's not too much, few words, not more than we can bear, making rash promises and vows that we can't fulfil. But here in chapter 6, the tables are turned. Doesn't matter how much goes into our mouths, our hunger for more is never satisfied. And he's not just talking about food, is he? For all of us, every aspect of life, whatever our pursuits are in acquiring more and more under the sun, will never be satisfied. That appetite will never be quenched. Whether it's money, more joy, more pleasure, more peace and quiet, more sanity, more security, under the sun, those appetites are never fulfilled. There's a constant restlessness. And in fact, the rapacious desire for more and more. I don't know, that might describe some of us this morning. Restless, unsettled, not content, unable to find peace and feel secure. Hunger pangs, craving for something different, but unable to find satisfaction, although you try and you try and you try. If that's the case for any of us here this morning, or anyone listening to this online for that matter, can I encourage you, look down. Check and ask yourself, where are my feet heading? Am I guarding my steps? And then look up, because wherever your feet are, unless you're really flexible, most of the time where your feet are heading, it's where your eyes are looking as well. Where are we looking? And who are we listening to? What are we looking for? That chorus, I try and I try and I try and I try, but can't get no satisfaction. If we're on that cycle, if we're on that restless pursuit, then more often than not, it actually sets us on a path of despair, or even a cycle of depression, maybe even addictions. But it can also lead us into what the scriptures call idolatry, because we're looking to other things than God. And sometimes all those things are mixed up together, and it's pretty tricky to work out which is which and what's actually happening. But the idolatry there is actually something which enslaves us, not just something we're chasing, but in the end we think we're going to get it, but it gets us. The very thing we want and perhaps have acquired has in fact acquired us. And as Wayne read from Psalm 115 at the beginning of our worship time, we actually become like the very thing the idol is. It gets us, and we become the object of our worship acquires us. There was an article and paper a few weeks ago about technology addiction in young people, and probably some old people as well. But it was, I think it was Korea that it was speaking about. They have boot camps for 12 and 13 year olds, and they take their parents along in boot camps to try to break technology addiction. But the psychiatrist who was mentioned in this article was saying to these kids, you keep looking at these things, your phones and your iPads and everything else. Nothing wrong with them. They're a good tool. They're a gift. But if you keep looking at them, and that's as big as your life is, you'll never have the intellect and mind to create this thing. There's a principle of idolatry in the scriptures that he was stipulating. The people who have made it aren't inside it, they're outside from it. But if that's all our life is, that's as big as our life gets, then we'll never actually be any bigger than it. With that idolatry, with that endless desire and pursuit for more and more, comes discontentment, unnecessary anxiety, sleepless nights. We heard about it in verse 12. Even if you've got everything you think you need, verse 12, the full stomach of the rich will not let him sleep. The very thing that he thought would give him comfort actually betrays him and denies him the very thing he wanted. He's too bloated to sleep, overindulged and over anxious. And so now his sleep is fitful and far from peaceful. Whereas the one who works, the one who labours, you ever just work hard out in the garden all day and you're just physically tired? You just get such a better night's sleep, don't you? Much better than sitting in front of a computer typing away all day, sort of mentally drained but physically done nothing. But the one who works and labours, perhaps even for the one who's pursuing all the money, he rests. No unnecessary anxiety, he's content. In fact, verse 20, he's almost so carefree about life and all things, he's almost got this healthy amnesia, a divine dementia of joy. What does it say? He will not remember much, or I think the version we heard was he will not recall his past or the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. He's so full of joy, he can't remember what he's done in his life because there's another day to live in the present to give thanks to God for what he has. God not only gives us our work and what we earn from our work that we might live, but also the power to enjoy it all, to accept our lot and rejoice. Without that gift, without that power to enjoy those things, life can be quite miserable, can't it? In fact, says the preacher in chapter 6, it would be better not to be born, or to be born and not live, than to have all the benefits of work and wealth and possessions, but not the gift and power to enjoy it. How could he say that? Surely he's making a gross exaggeration here. He's saying that a stillborn child could be better off than the one who has everything that life has to offer. Now, some of us here know all too well the suffering and the tragedy of stillbirth, of miscarriage. And the preacher's not being insensitive here, and I don't want to be either. But you see, what he's saying is under the sun, in the contrast between the two, between the man who has everything, long life, children, wealth, prosperity, but unable to enjoy any of it because he spends his whole life pursuing it. He has no joy, no peace. Whereas the stillborn child, despite knowing only a life of darkness, verse 5 of chapter 6, that child finds rest. Whilst the one who schemes and toils into the dark hours of the night knows no rest, despite all that they might achieve and accumulate. He might even live 1,000 years, twice over. But if he knows no rest, it amounts to the same, to nothing. Whereas the one who has known nothing but darkness knows something far greater than the one who has lived 2,000 years, because there's rest. Be still and know that I am God. All of us need that rest. All of us, really, all of our cries for more and our pursuit for joy, those appetites that are never satisfied, are really the hunger pangs for that rest. That rest that comes only from God. It's his rest that we hunger for. But we can be freed from those pangs, freed from the bondage and the slavery of idolatry that leaves us empty, freed from the power and the volume of those voices that vie for our attention and our worship. But we won't be free by trying all the more, trying and trying and trying, but instead by trusting and listening to God, hearing his word to us in the gospel: repent, believe, receive the forgiveness of sins, receive the glorious freedom of the children of God instead of the chains of slavery and idolatry. You see, God's core business in these last days is redemption and glory, freeing slaves, adopting his children as his sons and daughters, feeding his children so that we can be satisfied in him. And whilst the forms of slavery and slave masters may have changed in many places, it's still the same: idolatry, slavery, bondage, oppression. Take the technology, for example, that I mentioned before. Smartphones, whatever, mobile phones. As a teacher, even 5 years ago, if you confiscated a student's phone, it was like you were chopping off one of their arms. Like they just couldn't live without it. Well, guess what? What does Jesus say? If your right arm causes you to sin, chop it off. Now, we laugh, but there's actually an element of truth. Get rid of it. Get rid of the app. Turn it off. Turn off the internet, get up and do something else. It cannot give us life. It's a good gift, nothing wrong with it of itself. But don't worship the gift rather than the giver. It might make life easier and more convenient, but if it's got you, then it leaves you empty and it's got you captured. If you can't live without it, then it's no longer a tool, it's an idol, and you're a slave to it. friends, whether we're restless and can find no peace in life, or caught in the web, or the world wide web for that matter, trapped and enslaved to the things that are good gifts from God, there is hope. There's good news, the gospel of Christ, where his life and death and resurrection and his sovereign reign over us all now actually sets us free from all of those other things and brings us into the freedom of sonship. And at one point he even says, come and feed on me and you'll be satisfied. Only in him can we approach the throne, not casually, guarding our steps, but we can approach him with confidence and we can draw near to him and he will draw near to us. And we can hear his word and entrust ourselves to our faithful Creator. He's the only one who delivers and fulfills all his promises. None of the other voices of the world can ever do that. We heard him earlier this morning in our second reading from Matthew. I just want to finish with that now. Matthew 11. Come to me. Come to me, all who labour, all who try and I try and I try and I try. Those who can't get no satisfaction, come to me, Jesus says, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you. Let me guide your steps. Let me guard your steps. Let me lead you to still waters, to green pastures, to a table set before you, a banquet. Learn from me. How are we going to learn? Well, listen to me, for I am lowly and gentle. And you will find rest for your souls. For my yoke is easy. It doesn't lie heavy upon us. It's not wearisome. It's not a striving after the wind. My yoke is easy and my burden is light. All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is never satisfied. But whoever comes to Jesus our Lord, he says, shall not hunger. The hunger pangs, the appetite that's never satisfied, it will abate. Whoever believes in him shall never thirst. Feed and drink on the Lord, and you'll abide in him and he in you, and you will live forever in joyful, contented worship. We're going to stand and sing in a moment, but before we do, I want to pray the words of the song that we're about to sing. So let's pray. Speak, O Lord, as we come to you to receive the food of your holy word. Take your truth and plant it deep in us. Shape and fashion us in your likeness, that the light of Christ might be seen today in our acts of love and in our deeds of faith. Speak, O Lord, and fulfill in us all your purposes for your glory. And teach us, dear Lord, full obedience, holy reverence, and true humility. Test our thoughts and our attitudes in the radiance of your purity. Cause our faith to rise and our eyes to see your majestic love and authority. Words of power that can never fail. Let their truth prevail over unbelief. Speak, O Lord, and renew our minds. Help us grasp the heights of your plans for us, truths unchanged from dawn of time that will echo down through eternity. And by grace we'll stand on your promises, and by faith we'll walk as you walk with us. Speak, O Lord, until your church is built and the earth is filled with your glory. Amen.